Well, we're going to do a little bit here, a little check-in with stuff, course notes, things like that, before we get back to sort of where we left off last time. So first of all, Dave Rispoli, by the way, he never told me about this PMP dinner. but no one had a problem, or no one reported a problem, moving the final to the Tuesday, just 2 days before when it was. So it's still like week 11, it's still what the university calls finals week, but it no longer conflicts with the dinner for those of you who are graduating. Okay, so that's done, we just never followed up.
Was that an email or something?
Yeah. Yeah, there was an email, it was pretty early. If you have a problem, just talk to me. I think the reason why there was no problem, I mean, unless you had a pre-existing plan or something, is that, you know, so the university has this, like, random assignment of final slots, which makes no sense, so they move a Tuesday night class and put the exam on Thursday night. But fortunately, you know, for you guys, since you're generally taking only one class at a time, by moving the final, you know, it's not like we're conflicting with another final, but the university regulations are technically that it has to be unanimous, which is why we did this email thing. Anyway, there haven't been any problems with it, and it's a long ways off anyway, but I've been asked a couple times, hey, we never heard back from Dave, and I checked with him, and everything's fine. Okay? So homework two, I've sent a couple emails about it, but in case you haven't been checking, it is due 2 weeks from today, and I did update it this afternoon, and I'll talk about this in another couple minutes. If you already looked at it or already started on it, when you look at my updates, you'll see that none of your work was wasted. I didn't change any of the problems. I didn't really reorganize things. I made the assignment description I separated out some stuff. I actually provided a little bit more skeleton code, basically some good feedback from Ben based on what was unnecessarily difficult in homework one, which we're going to get to here in just a second. As long as we're talking about all this stuff, I took a brief look at the calendar, and I think logically and just, you know, where things fit, it'll make sense to have five homeworks, and I'd like to do anything I can to give you 2 weekends for each homework, just because I know that, you know, you may have something that one, you know, if there's only one weekend, it conflicts with life stuff. I'm not sure I can do that for homework 5, but I'll try to get it posted early, so at least maybe there's a weekend where there's 2 homeworks, or maybe we'll make it worth a little less. Again, it's a long way off, but if homeworks are due in weeks 3, 5, 7, 9, I run out of space. So I'm aware of that, and we'll figure it out when we get there. And that's kind of all the future stuff, but I did want to do a little bit, what I'm going to do now is do a little bit of a homework 1 post-mortem, kind of to cheer you guys up, or at least try to. And then spend a couple minutes talking about homework 2, give you a kind of a rough overview, so that, just because I think it might save a lot of time, so that when you, you know, go and read the assignment, you go, oh, yeah, Dan was talking about this. Okay, so if I can take 5 minutes now and save you an hour later, I'm more than happy to do it. Okay? All right. So, first of all, moving forward from homework 1, as we mentioned a couple times in the email, and I know there was a lot of emails, so, you know, I try and Ben tries to not send unnecessary emails because if we send it, we want you to read it. And I think we've kind of we exceeded that threshold the last few days, and we're going to try not to exceed it because, you know, I don't think there's anyone here who says, really? Because I don't really get enough email in my life. I would like to get some more. I don't really spend enough hours of my day staring at my inbox. And we're cognizant of that. But in any case, to repeat probably the most important point, we are not going to continue learning CAML programming features or new things about the environment or the compiler or anything like that. So in fact, moving forward, because the homework assignments will be focusing on, say, tougher programming language concepts, the CAML programming will actually be easier on an absolute scale, meaning the actual CAML programming will be easier for me on homework 4 than it was for homework 1. Which is really good news, because on a relative scale to someone just learning the language, that means it's going to get much, much easier. Okay, and that's by design. I would very much like that on future homework assignments, the CAML programming issues are not the focus. And I know that that's, you know, that's just the goal. We'll see how close we get. Okay, and I am roughly aiming for approximately less than 10 hours a week. Those are averages. It's going to take some people longer than it's going to take others. I was talking to someone over email today. I've actually taught, you know, similar versions of this course. I haven't done the PMP course before, but roughly similar, 5 homeworks, roughly the same sort of material. And at the end, I don't know if you remember this, when you fill out your course evaluation forms, you actually self-report how many hours you've been spending a week. I have no idea if those numbers are accurate. All I know is those are the numbers students filled in. And one time I've done this course, I got a 9.9 as the median, and the other I got a 10.5. Now, medians are funny. It means half the people are over. And I would like to crank this down a little bit, and I'm going to be working hard to do so. Okay, but that gives you the point that I think things will work out overall and be in the ballpark. That said, problem one on homework one was too hard. Okay, there I said it. I'm streaming on the internet. Why we thought it was doable, we knew it was a difficult algorithm, is we thought we gave a line-by-line English explanation, and we thought given the reference implementation, you had something to compare against and things like that. And in hindsight, given the number of emails that Ben has diligently replied to and the sort of questions we were getting, we just met you and we had to write the homework before the beginning of lecture one so that you could get started on it and live and learn. And that's where we are. I think part of it was also, when you get to homework two, you'll see that the homework problems are very similar to the code we've been, very similar to the type of stuff we've been talking about in class, whereas for homework one, we didn't talk about that stuff in class at all. Okay? So what I wanted to do now is actually spend a couple minutes just giving you an overview of what homework two is, and then we'll get back to the actual lecture stuff. Okay? All right. So homework two has two problems. The first one is to take the imp large step interpreter, which we went over last time, and that's exactly the code you'll start with. I posted it in a file called imp.ml, and it's exactly the code we went over. I literally pasted it into a new file. And you're going to add two things. You're going to add the ability to take your current heap and save the whole darn heap in a variable. That's something you can't do in any realistic programming language. Why? Because it's an expensive operation. But it makes perfect sense, and it's fun to play around with. And then if you're going to be able to save an entire heap in a variable, you ought to be able to use it later, and that's what restore heap does. So you're just going to take the interpreter, and you're going to change it to support these operations. And you have to make, 10 or 12 changes, but they're all really small. Okay? And that's the whole thing. Okay? And then in problem two, if you recall what we're doing in lecture, we have this programming language imp, and we've defined two semantics for it, a large step interpreter and a small step interpreter. And we're about to do a third one, which is going to be a translational semantics. We're going to translate it into some CAML stuff. And the idea is to take this other language, which I'm going to talk about for a minute on the next slide, and do the same thing. Right? So take everything we did for imp and do it for this other language. Okay? So it's an intellectual transfer of ideas. And we've added a lot of skeleton code. And that's why I reposted the assignment today, because Ben came into my office. And for those of you in Revan, you can probably figure out Ben's sitting that way. That's why I point that way every time I say Ben. He came into my office and he said, just do it like this. Make this a helper function. This will help them see a lot where part B is and where part C is and stuff. And hopefully that'll be helpful. And for those of you who really appreciate line counts, my solution to homework one was about like 170 lines over what we gave you, including problem four and all that stuff, which got a little big. And for homework two, it's like 70, way under half. So gives you a sense there too. Okay, so what does this Logo language look like? For those of you who were around in the early 80s, you might have heard a language called Logo. It was kind of fun, a turtle moved around. This is a simplification of it. Here's the BNF, which is straight out of the one of the documents I posted about the homework. So basically, an entire program is a list of moves, where a move, let's just call it an E. And so your moves are go home, which is basically the whole thing operates on a grid. So this is like the grid from high school math. This is the x-axis. This is the y-axis. And when you go home, you end up back at the origin facing that way. So you always have where you are and where you're facing. You can move forward a certain amount. That's a floating point number. You can turn a certain amount. That's a floating point number in radians. For those of you who haven't taken high school math in a while, all the way around is 2 pi. I always have to look that up. And we have for loops. So this is one move. This is actually an integer constant, so it's kind of a boring for loop. It knows it when you write the program how many times it's going to do it, and then a list of moves. Okay, so you'll notice that list of moves and moves are mutually recursive, but there's nothing wrong. That's no problem. Okay, so what's the that's just the syntax here. Obviously, I've started appealing to semantics here. The actual semantics of one of these move lists is a trace of places you've visited. So what's a place? It's a float cross float, x comma y. What's a trace? It's a list of them. And so when you run a program, you get back a list of the places you visit. Okay? It's that simple. It's actually a simpler programming language than IMP, but it's fun to play around with. And so a program state, remember in IMP, our program state was a heap and like the current statement. Right? That was enough to figure out what we had to do from that point forward. Well, here, we have our move list. That's like our current statement. It's the code we still have to execute. We have where we are on the grid. We have the current direction we're facing. Okay? And that's all we need. So you see how the ideas from one kind of translate to the other. As usual, loops are the hard case. Given a list, what do? Well, you figure out how to do the first thing on the list, and then you figure out how to do the rest of the list. And, you know, this is all explained in about 3/4 of a page in a file called logo.pdf, but I thought maybe a picture and talking about it out loud for a minute or two would help. Okay? Questions? Comments?
Sure, I'll ask.
Yeah, sure.
So on the mutual recursion thing, in the environment of Eve's definition, I guess, well, this isn't camel, but...
Right. Great question. Okay, so in camel, what's a couple... Okay, let me... I kind of need to remember how to go to a whiteboard. There we go. Okay. So mutual definition. So great question. As long as we're going to talk about camel, let's talk about camel a little. You know, if you have a question. If you have two functions that need to refer to each other, my standard example is even and odd, written the world's dumbest way. So the definition of even is going to find out if I minus 1 is odd, unless it's 0. The definition of odd is going to find out if I minus 1 is even, except for 0. I'm not going to actually write the bodies. But imagine that the way you figure out if a number is even or odd is mutually recursive. You call the other one. You just use the keyword and. I guess I usually use green for keywords. Odd, I, equal. But that's for functions. There, we are defining data types. So if you wanted to define two mutually recursive data types, and you're actually going to have to do this in problem 1, even though you were thinking about problem 2, it's the same keyword and. You say type T1 equals, and then whatever you want, and T2 equals, and whatever you want. Okay, so they do have to be co-located in the file, just the limitation of camel, but that's how you do it. It turns out for logo, what you'll see when you download logo.ml is I've already started for you. You have to define the data type, but I've started it for you. I've said type move, that was the E, equals home, that's the home kind of move, or, and then the rest of this is commented out. You have to do it. Okay? And then I was like, you might think, well, and I need a move list. So I might define, you know, and move list equals, say, empty or cons of, and so on. But I didn't actually do that. I just kind of took a small shortcut. You totally could do that. That would be a fine solution. But everywhere I needed a move list, I just used camel's built-in list. It said move list. Okay, remember, list is a type constructor, and so this is just a list of moves. And now I didn't have to define a second type. Just everywhere I needed a move list, and there were a bunch of places in the file, I just wrote out the move list. Okay? All right. Back to here. So, I know another way to do it.
I guess I'll just have to write the rest of the lecture by hand.
Yeah. I can have it printed out. It would just be a lot of really bad handwriting. Okay. So before we get back to the lecture, Ben said, please remind them one little thing in camel. And I said, well, since you've replied to 7,562 emails in the last 48 hours, I guess I'll grant your request. And here's the most common thing, and he did this in an email as well. But there's two things that look very, very similar in camel because they both involve the keyword let and an equals. Okay? And one of them is a top-level binding. Ben called this a statement. And it is kind of a statement in the sense of, just like our IMP statements, they affect something, but they don't produce an answer. So what is a top-level binding do? And I mean top-level as in not inside a function definition or a variable definition or something like that. You say let pattern, in the simplest case just a variable, but there are a lot of different possibilities, equal an expression. If you want to be really, really sure that the parser will separate this from what follows, you can toss in two semicolons. That's a nice way to debug syntax errors if you're not sure where one top-level binding in the next starts. Those are optional, but when your code has a parse error, they can help localize where that error is. And the semantics of this is evaluate E, unless P is a function, of course. Evaluate E, produce a result, and then you extend the top-level environment so that the variables in P are bound for the rest of the file. Okay? Those are the top-level bindings, and our whole program has really been a sequence of top-level bindings. There are other kinds of top-level bindings, like exceptions and types. Okay? The second possibility is how we define local variables, and that looks like this. So we say let p equal 1 in E2. Okay? And I guess the key differences are, first of all, the bindings in P only exist for E2. But the second thing is that this whole thing is an expression. Okay? And the result of the whole thing is what is the result of E2. Okay? So we could add such a thing to imp. It wouldn't be too hard. Okay? And a lot of times, just as a final point, and Ben didn't mention this to me today, it looks like you're doing a bunch of let ins, and then you have some final thing, en. Okay? And that's fine. It turns out that's not a special language construct. You're just saying that each successive one, the outer E2 is itself a let in, and then the next one is another let in. And we just don't indent further because we don't feel like falling off the right side of the screen. Okay? People okay with that? Nice little ease us back into to ML. All right. Okay. On we go. Where were we actually in our deep and meaningful investigation of semantics? We were learning everything there was possibly to know about while loops and mutable variables, and we did it two different ways. Okay, we had abstract syntax, we had two interpreters, that was our large step and our small step. Recall that because we had learned CAML, we decided to make our meta language, the language in which we define the interpreter, be CAML. And what we're moving toward now is a completely different style of definition, where instead we're going to translate to another language. We're still going to write our translator in CAML, and we're going to make our target language be CAML. But not just like full CAML, a very restricted subset of CAML that only has sort of the very basics. And if you want to know where this is going kind of in the course, is if this language had like a really well understood meaning, then you toss in our translation and now imp has a really well understood meaning. And that's where we're moving. We're going to take a language that just has functions and strings and ints and conditionals and do to it what we did to imp. And then we'll have a very rich language because we'll have functions, and with functions you can do anything. Okay? So, this is the data type we've been dealing with. This is straight out of last time. So remember, we have expressions, they have integers, variables, additions, multiplications. And then statements use expressions, so our whole program is a statement. We have skip, which does nothing. We have assignments, which updates our heap. We have sequences, which does the left, then the right. We have if statements, and we have while statements. And once you learn the type of something, you can kind of use it to remind you what the code was doing up to a point. And so in some sense, what we were doing last time is we wrote four functions. All right. Our large step interpreter had a function for statements that used a function for expressions. And we decided that what a statement, the way you run a statement is you take in a heap and a statement and you produce a new heap. So what statements do is they make changes to the heap. And rather than encode that as sort of treating the heap as a mutable data structure, we'll just produce a new heap that reflects those changes. Expressions are much easier. They operate on a heap and an expression, and they just produce the integer. They don't actually change the heap. They just produce 37 or 19 or negative 3. There's a few other possibilities. there's also, okay, then we went to small step, and we said small step, we're going to break this down into tiny little steps. Okay? So what we're going to do each time around some outer loop is we're going to take a heap and a statement, and we're going to produce a new heap, which is what our one little computation step did, and then we're going to produce another statement, which is sort of the rest of what I have to do before I terminate, if I terminate. And similarly, for expressions, we take a heap and an expression. Again, it won't change the heap, but we can talk about the simpler expression that results. And eventually, for an expression, you'll get all the way down to an integer. Okay? So I think I will skip this slide, but I just wanted to point out that we did discuss last time some of the relative advantages from a definitional standpoint of small versus large. And I claimed a theorem, and I guess I even sketched it informally waving my hands, that the two languages actually always produce the same answer, okay, which is nice to know. We basically have two different ways of defining the language, but they agree. They completely agree. That's something we could investigate more if we wanted to. Okay? And so now we're going to take a different approach. And again, these are still slides from last time for one more slide, I guess, where what we're going to do is we're going to define a compiler, except I'll call it a translator, I guess, to produce a target program. And the name of the game here is if we define the compiler and we assume someone else has defined the semantics of this program, then this picture is a semantics for this program. Right? It says the semantics of a source program is run it through my compiler and apply the semantics that someone else already defined for the result. Okay? And that is a totally legit definition. But we got to do it. Right? People okay with this? That's the setup. Okay? And I think actually this might be the trickiest thing we do in the class. So timing wise, given that I just threw homework one at you, I kind of wish I could put this off, but this is the place for it. And hopefully it'll be fun. So put your lambda, you know, your function caps on, and we'll get there. Okay? Did this last time. I don't think it'll help us to go over again, except for one point, which is we are going to be slightly confused. I'm just flipping back here by the fact that we're going to write our compiler in CAML, and we're going to produce a program that's in CAML. Okay? And I'll try to be clear about what is what. Okay? And there will be advantages of doing that. I could write my translator in CAML and say, produce strings that I then pass to a C compiler. That would work. That would be a translational semantics. It wouldn't be as pleasant. Okay? So we're going to do expressions first. And let me tell you the goal here. Okay? So this is where we're gonna, you know, kinda roll up our sleeves and get into this. We're gonna write a function translate E, translate expressions, X sometimes pronounced trans, shorter than TRANS. Okay? And what is its type? It's gonna take in an expression. Okay, that's our old imp thing, our old imp abstract syntax, the actual code. And it's gonna produce a function from heaps to ints. That's the way I'd like to think about that. Now, it doesn't say heap to int because it's not a heap anymore. It's not that type heap that we defined earlier, which was just a string star int list. Now we're going to say, no. In our translated world, a heap is a function from strings to integers. So if we focus just on that part, I'd like you to grant me that that makes a lot of sense. That a perfectly good way to think about a heap is something that takes in a string and returns an integer. People okay with that? Right? So everywhere in these slides where you see string arrow int, just think heap. All right? It's going to be a translated heap. It's going to be something that takes a string and returns an integer. But keep doing that macro reverse substitution in your head. All right, you see string arrow int, that's a heap. And so now what we're doing is we're translating an expression to something that's going to take one of these functions, one of these representations of a heap, and produces an int. Now here's the way I like to think about it. I like to say that an expression is a function from heaps to ints. And our translation is going to show you that. And if that sounds weird, if you liked our old world where we say, oh, we're going to have some function in terp that's going to take a heap and an expression and returns an int, and you don't like our new world where we say an expression is something that can be passed a heap and return an int, then you don't like object-oriented programming. Okay? This to me is very OOP. Okay? We're saying this guy is like an object that has a method, run me on this heap. Okay? It's just the only method it has. Because the only thing you can do with a function is call it. You can't say, I want to call method M. You have to just call it. So the only thing you can do with an expression is throw it a heap, throw it a string arrow int, and get back an int. Okay? Where I meant throw informally. Not nothing to do with exceptions. Okay? So we're going to do expressions first, but for those of you who want to see where statements are going, well, we're going to translate a statement to something that takes a heap and returns a heap. Or as I like to put it, being a little mathy, a statement is just a heap transformer. Right? Takes a heap and returns a heap. Okay? So those are our types. This is going to be our goal, and it's going to very much guide what we do. Okay? All right. Here's expressions. We're going to go one line at a time. They get progressively harder, although, as usual, plus and times are equally difficult. Okay? All right. So this is repeated from the last slide. This is what we have to do. Translate E has to take in an X, and it has to produce one of these guys. Now, what I'm going to do in each case, as you can see, is I'm going to end up producing something that looks like fun H arrow something, which makes a lot of sense. I'm producing a function. It takes in a heap, and it's going to somehow produce an int. All right? So the integer case happens to be very easy. You just return the integer I. So the way this compiler works is someone walks along and hands it an int 7, and it returns a function that takes a heap, ignores it, and returns 7. So that's our translation. Okay? Now that's just integers. They're boring, but they're a very good place to start. Okay? No one's run for the doors yet. Okay. So let's do the variable case. Now remember, the variable case back when we had an interpreter is where we took our very concrete heap, our heap that had a list, that had strings and it had integers, and we called this lookup function that did this nice kind of procedural thing. It walked down the heap and it found the one we were looking for. Well, that's not going to work anymore. What we have to do is we have to produce a function that takes a heap. Now this is a translated heap. This is a string arrow int. And does the lookup. But that's not hard. You just have to believe me that what you do is you take the heap, which is itself a function, and you pass it the string. That'll give you back this integer, and that's what we want. One of the keys of teaching is knowing when to shut up. Pause for a few seconds. Let people stare at it. It definitely type checks, right? This is a string arrow int. This is a string, so I get back an int. And that means my whole thing takes a string arrow int and returns an int. And put another way, you give me a heap, I'll call it. I'll call its lookup method, right? But the way it only has one method. It only has call. And the way you do call is you just write the argument next to it. That's actually the hard case. Although the other cases can actually be messed up. So let me show you. These are the right solutions. I'm going to show you the wrong solution in a couple minutes so that we can fully appreciate how cool this one is. Okay? So let's do plus, and then we'll probably skip times because it's identical, just the plus becomes a time. Okay? So we have to produce a function eventually that takes in a heap. Okay? Now clearly, you know, the basics of plus have not changed. We're still going to compute our recursive results and add them together. But we don't want to do that right now. We're not running the program right now. Notice there is no heap here. We can't actually evaluate expressions. All we have is the expression. We're translating it to some CAML program that we can run later. Right? So what we're going to do, just like any compiler would do, and if you've never written a compiler, let me let you in on their secrets, they translate all the code. Right? That was a joke. Right? So a plus has two sub-expressions, E1 and E2. So let's just translate them. I'm sure it will be useful. Okay? Let's let F1, F for function, because we're translating things to functions, be the result of translating E1. Let's let F2 be the result of translating E2. Okay? So now what are those things? Those are now things that if you give them a heap, they'll give you back an integer. So the translation of plus is itself going to take a heap, and it should use that heap in its method call to F1 and F2, in its call. Right? It should say, all right, I'm something that if you give me a heap knows how to produce an int, so I'm going to pass it along, get back this result, that'll be some int, I'll pass it to F2, that'll give me some other int, and I'll add them together. Okay? Now what is cool about this? This is kind of the key point, is that when I have this guy, okay, it uses three variables in its body, F1, H, and F2. H is its argument. At runtime, when we actually run this program, it's actually given a heap, and it uses it. But F1 and F2, these are these free variables. This is this closure we're creating. And in object sense, these are its private fields. These guys, F1 and F2, are not imp expressions anymore. They are the result of the translation. They are themselves one of these funny, fun H arrow things. Okay? So this function only refers to other kind of functions that look like this, 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 or this. So when you put it all together, when we're done running translate E, there's no need for this X data type anymore. When we actually get the result of this translation and use it, we're never going to encounter an int constructor, a var constructor, a plus constructor, a times constructor. And that's what I meant by you can throw, after you've done your translation, you can throw your abstract syntax for imp away. It's gone. Okay? If that didn't make sense, I'm going to give you another shot at it. But that's the moral we're working toward. Okay? Questions? Feel free to interrupt any time, of course, but sometimes I remember. Okay. So I thought we could actually go through an example. This mostly just says what I just said, the words down here. So our example here, and I put the code here because it's actually online and you can play with it later. Let me write it as a tree. It's a plus with a 3 and a times with an x and a 4. So that's our input, right? That's what we're going to call translate E with on this line right here. Okay? So now I don't have near enough room on this slide, so let me just switch over to the blank page and rewrite this tree and then what our translate E would produce. And I need a new one. Perfect. So if I recall correctly, it was plus 3 times x and 4. And if not, let's just pretend it was. Okay? And you may have the slide in front of you. If not, you know, just I know what it does in my head. So the first thing it does is it hits a plus, and it says, okay, the first thing the plus case does in translate E is it translates the two subtrees. Right? It's one subtree, there's the other subtree. So the first thing it does is it translates the left subtree. And that ends up producing a fun H3. Right? We've now translated this guy. Now we've got to translate this guy. And the first thing it does is just like the plus case, is it translates its left subchild. So that's going to be some function that takes an H and applies it to X. Okay? Now we're going to translate the right child. That's going to be some function that's going to take an H and return 4. Okay? Now I've done this, this, and this. I was in the middle of translating this. And if you look at the times case, that takes a function and it multiplies these guys together like this. And now if you're confused by all the... Sorry, let me get that right.
One more close.
Here?
At the very end. Yeah.
The very end, okay. All right. So if you don't like all these H's, we can change some of them. I can make this H1 and H1 and this H2 if I like. So what's going on is the translation of times becomes something that takes a heap, passes it to this function. And when I pass it to this function, I'm going to end up looking up x on that heap. Then I'm going to pass that same heap to this thing that ignores it and returns 4. And then I'm going to multiply those two things together. So that's what went on here. Now when I pop up to the plus, I become a fun, what letter am I up to? Let's say H3. It passes H3 to that guy, and it adds passing H3 to this whole guy. One more close. And that's what I mean. That is the result of my translation. And I haven't produced an answer yet. All I did was write a compiler. I took in a program. I don't have a heap yet. All I've said is at runtime, when I have a heap, just call me, because I'm a function that takes a heap and produces an integer, and I'll give you an answer. Okay? And that's exactly what TranslateE did. And this is what I mean by the result of this translation doesn't use our constructors, int, var, plus, and times. Okay? Which is kind of a nice property of a compiler. You don't want the result of your compiler to sort of still be using your source language. Because then what was the point? You still need it around. Okay? Questions? Please.
So what gets produced at this point? Does code get generated when you create this tree, or does it, mm-hmm. or is there some sort of abstract data type that gets created that then is interpreted as code?
Yeah. So what you can think of it as generating. I mean, this I don't quite know how to answer your question. This is what gets produced, right? This is an ML thing. Mm-hmm. Now, when you call OCaml-C or OCaml, like, is it actually generating assembly code? Well, yeah. Is it creating data structures that use that code? Yeah. But our target language, rather than being sort of bits and assembly code, is just sort of CAML source code. And it does raise the question of, well, how is CAML source code then represented? Right? So after you did a translation to your target language, now, well, is that target language interpreted directly? Or is it further translated to yet another language? And in some sense, that's a separate question, but I understand why you're asking it now, which is sort of, well, I produced this. What is this? Right? I could have actually produced a string. I could have literally produced a string, written it to a file, and called OCaml-C on it. The reason why I didn't do that, well, there's a couple reasons. One is, this way the OCaml type checker will help me. Right? I told the OCaml type checker, I always want a string arrow int. And if I mess it up when I'm writing this stuff, I'll get some help. Whereas with strings, the compiler will work, but then when I try to use the resulting string, it'll fail. Did I come close to answering your question?
So it will dynamically generate code when you create this expression?
It won't, actually. And for that, I'm going to delay you at least till next week, maybe the week after, when I tell you how languages like ML are actually implemented. Yeah.
This, see if I can get loud enough so Redmond can hear too. This generates code in the same sense that when you call the higher order function last week, you said, make adder with 6, and it created the plus 6 function. This is generating code in the same exact sense that that generated code. It is a function value somewhere or another inside OCaml's runtime environment. When that value gets evaluated, it runs. So in some sense, yes, it's code. In another sense, no, it's a value. if you were to freeze that value out to a file, then yeah, that's code. You know, you can represent it as code. But what it actually is the same kind of values that we created last week when we were doing higher order functions. We just got part of the way there. We still need a heap to finish evaluating.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess the bottom line is, yeah, it's kind of a red herring to talk about generating code, although I very much appreciate the question. What we have produced is one of these guys. Right? What can you do with that? You can call it. Right? And in particular, the one we created was this one. Okay? It doesn't quite look like this one in when you look at our translation, and that's because we use these lets. But the rule when you have a variable in here like F1 is that it refers to whatever was created out here. And that's exactly what I did by hand. I just didn't use let variables. Okay? All right. So even if you don't understand, this is the sort of thing you kind of have to stare at. It's why I'm going to have you do something similar in Logo so you actually get to play around with this. But I hope you believe me that, you know, this thing, the result of our translate doesn't have any of those constructors in it, like plus and times and int and var. Because I showed you an example, and it's pretty clear that none of the cases ever use that. Let me do two things now. The first thing I'm going to do is show you what you actually do with one of these results. Then I'm going to show you the wrong way of doing this translation, which unfortunately does type check. The reason why it type check is there's no way in OCaml to say, and my result can't use the exp data type. Right? I mean, that's what I've been going at here, and I can't actually force that. But I can show you what happens if you get it quote-unquote wrong. But before I do that, remember that f now is the result of translate e is something that if passed the heap gives you back an integer. But a heap now is a string arrow int. Well, here's a perfectly fine example. This is my initial heap. Takes a string and returns 0, and sure enough, if you do this, and I provided the code to you, you'll get back 3.
Oh, yeah.
Right, 3, yeah, because 0 times 4 is 0, plus 3 is 3. Okay? And at this moment, we could throw away our exp data type. We don't need it to do this evaluation. Okay? Let me show you the wrong code, because I think it might illuminate what I mean by you do all the translation ahead of time. So let me show you. This is the correct code. I think I can just erase everything. There we go. There's the correct code. And notice particularly what the plus case looks like. Translate E1, translate E2, return a function that when run uses the results of those translations. Okay. Now let me show you the wrong code. Produce a function that when run translates E1, translates E2, passes H to the results of those translations, and then adds them together. This type checks. OCaml will run this fine. But let me try to explain in English what it's doing. What this is doing is it's saying, if you have a plus, produce a function that keeps this syntax around and keeps this syntax around because the body of the function refers to E1 and E2. And when you call this function later at runtime, go and translate 3, then go and translate this whole thing, and then run the resulting functions. Okay? That's just not what compilers do. Right? They don't like do one little bit of compiling and then delay the rest until later.
It's like a small step compiler.
Yeah, it's kind of like a small step compiler, I guess. What's that?
There's an industry term for that.
An industry term meaning which one?
Just in time.
It's just in time, but it's like it's worse than just in time. It's like saying, well, you executed the first part of the expression, so I'll compile that. And I'll wait till you get to like the other part of the plus, and then I'll compile that. Now, there are JIT compilers that will go like one method at a time. They won't JIT a method until you actually call that method. But at least then, they'll compile it like once and for all, and you'll have the result. Okay. So I guess the point here is really just to say that in this meta language, even though it might not be obvious because we're still getting used to the meta language, we can talk about when things happen. Okay? So back here in the write version, at translation time, I do this, and I create a value that uses the results. But just like in every function, in every programming language you've probably ever seen, function bodies don't execute until the function gets called. And I'm not calling this function here, I'm producing it. And if we go to the wrong version, again, now I have a situation where this function body is not getting called until later when I call the function, right? And that's too late to do translation. I was supposed to do my compiling ahead of time.
So is the problem that there's essentially a new definition of translate that takes a heap? And that before, there was really no definition of translate that took a heap? And so that's how you can get this problem.
I don't think so. I think it's really that translate is not happening until I call this function.
And so if it's not in your language, in your generated language, you're in trouble?
Yeah. So now I really am producing supposedly translated code that in it refers to ints and vars and pluses.
So your translated language has your source code. A meta language, right. Basically. In
yeah,
it,
yeah.
Which is probably bad.
Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, it's not really what we're going after. And if I had used different languages, this would have been way more obvious. If I had tried to produce like a C string that had like calls to camels translate E in it, this would have been a red flag.
But this will work because your translated function and your target language are the same.
This will work just fine. Yeah. Okay. So
it wouldn't work if it was C.
And it wouldn't work if it were C because I have different languages. Absolutely. Okay. Questions?
Doesn't that translate E bind the H into itself? Or is that?
This is just a function call that returns a function.
Right.
And then I call it with the H.
Yeah.
All right.
Never mind.
Yep. No. Yep. Good. I kind of wish now in hindsight it would have taken a little more room in the slide. I really should have stuck with the lets. I should have just taken these lets and moved them into the function body. Then the code would have looked even more similar, but you would have seen that I was doing the lets later. Okay? And then the wrong would have looked more like the right. Okay. And I'm not allowed to type right now. Okay. All right. I'm going to move on to statements. They're actually, the first several cases are not so hard once we have, now that we have the hang of this. We're thinking kind of OO, we're thinking, oh, I have functions, I can call them. Okay. So the first few cases of statements, but it's been a few minutes, so let me remind you what the type of a translated statement is. So the goal of translate-s is to produce a heap transformer, something that takes a heap and produces a heap. That's the result. And this is my favorite thing, because I'm kind of strange like that. Skip is the identity function. Okay? Whatever heap you pass it, it returns the same heap. And this is how you write that, right? Skip becomes a function that takes a heap and returns that heap. Okay? Skip becomes an object that has a method, which is run me, but I need a heap as an argument. I give you back a heap as a result, and I give you back the same one. Assignment, remember back when we did interpretation, we have to do an update. So again, I'm being very careful to do all my translation in advance. So assignment has an expression in it. I've fortunately already defined translate E, so that will produce some function. This F will have type string arrow int, which I'm going to use here in a moment. So then later at runtime, when you actually have a heap, let's find out what that expression actually returns. So we'll call f with h. We'll get back an integer I. And now we have to produce this result heap. Okay? This is the one place in our code where we actually produce a new kind of heap. What's a heap? It's a function from strings to integers. Function, string, integer. And if the string you pass to this heap is str, then you should produce I. Otherwise, you should produce whatever the heap you were passed would have produced. Not getting any nods. I'm going to give it another go. And then you guys will learn to lie to me. No, please don't. Yeah. If I've lost everybody, then I need to know, because, you know, I already know how this works. Okay. I don't think any of this is all that useful. So, this is what I'm returning. So, I'm taking in a heap, and I'm returning a heap. A heap is a function from strings to integers. Okay? So, I take in a string. Okay? And what I do is I see if that string is the same string that I'm currently assigning to. And if it is, the integer I return is the result of running the expression. But I'm in this translated world, so I originally had translated the expression, now I have a function, I pass it my old heap, I get back an I. Otherwise, I'm not doing anything different, I'm just like my old heap. But a heap is a string arrow integer. I was passed it just like that. So if I want to know what integer to return in my result heap, then I have to call my old heap with s. That seemed to work a little better. Okay? Right. That's kind of the heart of the whole thing, actually. Okay? So that's the hard case. Skip was easy because it doesn't do anything. This is hard because you actually have to produce some kind of new heap, some new string arrow int. Sequence is pretty easy. It's also pretty darn elegant, if I do say so myself. Translate the two sub-expressions, giving you back two heap transformers. Then you become something that takes a heap and produces a new heap. So what do? Well, you call the first heap transformer on H. That gives you back some heap. You pass that to the second heap transformer. That gives you back some third heap, and that's what you return. And so what was sequence in our source language becomes function composition, or call the first function, get something back, pass it to the second function, and it works like a charm.
How is the order irrelevant in that?
The order is irrelevant right here, because if I have in my C compiler, substitute your favorite language, S1 semicolon S2, do you really care which one you translate first? No. Just need to generate assembly code for both and then stitch it back together.
But it does matter. Yeah, oh, I see now.
Yeah, good. I'm really glad you reminded me of these comments, because they really emphasize this whole certain things are happening at one stage and certain things are happening at a second. So, thank you. Yeah. All right. One more easy case, and then I get to leave everybody in the dust, I'm afraid. Because we got to do while, and I warned you, while is always the toughest. Okay, but I got to show it to you. All right, so if, same thing, order is irrelevant right here. Translate S1, translate S2, translate E. We get three pieces of target code. It could be assembly if I were doing assembly. Instead, it's camel functions. Now I have to produce a heap transformer. My heap transformer takes an H. It passes H to F and sees if it gets 0 or not. Based on whether it gets 0 or not, it chooses to run this heap transformer or this heap transformer. Okay. I've kind of cheated here. Not really. I mean, my syntactic if has become a camel if. But that's a good compiler. I mean, that's a good translator. I mean, use what you got. Right? All right, so that's the good news. People seem pretty happy with that. I'm flipping back here. After you've seen sequence, going from sequence to if, it's kind of the same thing. Assign was kind of our base case where something interesting happened. Skip was the identity function. And now we got while. Okay? While is hard. Okay? Probably the hardest thing I show you in the entire class. That's okay. You got to get it right on one case of one homework problem. And then you get to move on in life. Okay? So here's the easy part of while. translate the subparts. Every compiler does it, we should do it too. Okay? So we're going to translate the body, we're going to translate the guard, the order doesn't matter. Now we've got functions. We have something that takes in a heap, produces an integer, we have something that takes in a heap and produces a heap. So what's the problem? Well, the problem is I need to come up with something that, let's see, if f of h equals 0, well, then I don't want to do anything, right? That's the meaning of while loops. If the guard is false, don't change the heap. Let's put it another way. If the guard is false, it's just like you wrote skip. Let's put it another way. If the guard is false, return the same heap you were passed. So far, so good. Else, let's see, I need to call F1, I need to do the body. Right? The way that I do the body is I take the heap I was passed and I send it to the heap transformer that is the translation of the body. But then you know what I have to do? I have to then take that and pass it to the heap transformer that's the translation of the whole while loop. Right? Transform the heap using the body, but then I need my translation of the whole while loop. And this would be fine if boxes and arrows were in camel. But they're not. And I could say, you know, here's another idea. This is not going to work at all. I don't like to mislead you. I could say, well, let's just put in some F2 here, where I say let F2 equal translate S while E S1 in. Someone want to knock down my straw man?
We don't have the syntax.
I do have the syntax. This is out here. This is before here. Excellent first try.
I don't know how many times it's going to loop.
I don't know how many times it's going to loop. I do know how many times, if I write this exact code, translate S is going to loop. It's an infinite loop. I've inside of translate S recursively called translate S with the exact same thing. So this is kind of a trivial mistake. You run your first test case with a while loop, and you're like, oh my god, I generated an infinite amount of code. Right? The result of my translation needed the result of my translation, so I decided to very eagerly, very ahead of time, generate an infinite number of functions because I didn't know how many times the loop would go around. If I knew how many times it was going to go around, then I could have generated sort of n things and I could have translated this to sort of n if-then-elses, maybe? I don't know. If I lost it, I lost it. You know, whatever. So the red's not going to work. And that's the only way I can get a translation of while ES1, which is what I need right here. So I'm actually going to kind of go back to my first approach and say, maybe there is a way to write this arrow.
Like recursive let?
Yeah.
In?
Yeah. Camel has recursive functions. I just wrote it like a freshman. You know, and I want to call it again. Right? We have that. And this is the big trick. Alright? And it's very clever. I would never come up with this. Someone showed this to me. Okay? This part is exactly like before. Translate the statement, translate the expression. And then the result, our heap transformer, is a recursive function in our target language. So what was a while loop in our source language is a recursive function in our target language. How do we write recursive functions? We use the rec keyword, we give them a name, okay, and now this function can call itself. It takes in a heap, it sees if that heap is zero or not. If it's not, sorry, I inverted my if-then-else from my scribbles on the previous slide. If it is zero, act like a skip. If it's not zero, call the heap transformer that's the body, and then call yourself. Okay, I'm going to flip back for just a second. It's exactly this. Okay? Someday a classroom presenter will let me pick this up and put it on the next slide. All right? That's exactly what this is. That's pretty cool. And what's really cool about it is that while loops became recursive functions. Okay? And you have to do this somehow. If our target language, and this is what I mean down here, if our target language had no loop and no recursion, you cannot do this. Right? You need something. If you're translating to assembly and you have while loops, you need a backward branch. Right? You need something. You cannot, ahead of time, translate a language with while loops to something that only has conditionals and assignments and sort of forward calls. And it's exactly because we don't know how many times we're going to go around the loop. We can't know at translation time. We have to know at runtime. Okay? Questions? That's almost the whole thing. We've actually been following, if you go back and look at these slides later, I know it might actually happen. We've done three semantics. We did large step, small step, now we've done translation. The slides actually follow a very similar format. In fact, even the titles on the slides I've tried to line up. And they always end with, well, we've done statements, now what about whole programs? Remember, now we've translated statements, now we have something. For a whole program, we've always said, you start with a heap that maps everything to zero, and when you're done, you read out the answer variable. And I know it's been a week since we did that for the interpreters, but that is what we did. So let me finish the story for translation. Here's how you finish the whole story. If you wanted to interpret a program, a new way to interpret a program is to translate it, get a heap transformer, pass the initial heap, that gives you back a string arrow int, or whatever hieroglyphics approximate that. And then you can pass the string ants to that string arrow int and get your result back. So that's the final piece of the puzzle. Okay? And just to throw jargon at you, I would never test you on this, but just in case someone asks what it is you've been doing, if our target language had been mathematics instead of camel, this would have been a quote-unquote denotational semantics. It's just a fancy word. Okay. Just like for interpreters, the fancy word was operational semantics. Okay? Questions? We did it. I think that's the hardest material in the course, actually. Maybe continuations, which we'll hopefully get to next week. Yeah, please.
Where did that string ANS come from?
ANS, yes. We merely decided that when we run a whole program, what we really get back is a heap. But is that your answer? So we just decided as the language designers that the output, when you're all done, your exit code, is the value in the ANS variable.
So it's the runtime system that's setting that ANS variable for us.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's part of your program.
Your program,
you'll
yeah.
say ants equals blah, blah, blah. And so the runtime system is reading out that value.
Ah, okay. So we...
Just like if you're in C, you would have to say exit 0. Here you would say ants equals 0. And then the runtime, when it runs it, will say, oh yeah, I need to look up ANS.
Yeah, I kind of like calling this like the return value from main, although in a lot of languages now that's a void. yeah, I'm just saying, I mean, we could have just defined that the end result of a whole program is the whole darn heap. But, you know, some people say, well, that's ridiculous. You don't at the end of program say, well, here's the whole heap. You say, like, here's an individual value. Of course, what you really do is you worry about, like, what I.O. has been done, but imp doesn't have I.O., so we didn't get into that.
Like factorial would take its factorial output and put it in ANS.
Exactly. When you're all done, main or factorial, your end result thing assigns to ANS, and that's what the outside world, the caller of interp prog, is going to see. Yeah. Okay. So you can skip this step. You can skip this whole slide, but then I feel like it's kind of, you know, you're not finishing the story. Right? You're saying, well, I ran a statement, I got some heat. Well, who cares? It's when you're all done, well, read some variable and say that's your answer. And I just picked ANS because it's shorter than ANSWER. Cool. All right, so that's it for how that's like honestly everything about imp. We're going to, well, that's not true. We're going to talk about equivalences, but that's all we're going to do for defining imp. We've defined it three different ways. There's this very deep theorem that, in fact, they're all equivalent. I've shown you three different finishing the story slides, three different interp prog definitions, and it turns out if you pass them all the same statement and the same initial heap and then read the answer variable, you'll always get the same thing. That's pretty cool. We're not going to show it. Okay? We avoided some things. We skipped about 3 months of stupid mathematics. We will come back to a different meta language, but we're not going to do it for imp. Maybe we'll do it on a homework assignment. Probably not. Okay. And there's this point that why did we translate to this funny target language? Well, because CAML was already implemented. It already has a semantics. One we're going to investigate more carefully. And that way, you know, our translation, translate E and translate S, was a semantics for imp, but only because our target language had one. Okay? And the real punchline, the hardest part of that translation, excuse me, exposed a deep, deep connection between loops and recursion. Okay? So what I think I will do now is I will go on a total digression and actually relate this back to an operating system concept and some other things that exist in the real world, and then we'll take a break. Okay? So what I want to do, and this is somewhat embarrassing, even though I'm streaming over the internet, is I want to tell you everything I know about packet filters. Okay, just quick show, raise your hand if you've ever heard of a packet filter. Okay, about half of you. Here's all you have to know. Think network packets. Okay, think wires. There's this wire and a packet arrives. A packet is just a sequence of bits. Okay, some bits come in off the wire and they hit your desktop machine. Your desktop machine is running lots of applications, and the operating system does not know which applications want that packet. Okay? It has no idea. The operating system is the only thing that can read the wire. The operating system doesn't want network packets. It's just a conduit. It just passes them off to applications. Okay? So we have this mismatch. The operating system controls the resource. The applications want the data on the resource. So the application and the operating system have to communicate. Okay, and what we need is some way for the applications to say which packets they want. Okay, the naive way that people did for a little while, except the performance sucked, is some application says, I'm interested in network packets. Some other application says, I'm interested in network packets too. And so the operating system keeps track and says, these are the 7 processes that like network packets. And every time some bits come in off the wire, I'll just make a copy of those bits and send them to all 7 applications. Okay? And the problem with that is that it's hugely wasteful. You have to copy, because you can go take the OS class to learn that it's a huge security problem if you let the applications actually point into the OS data structures. And most of the applications don't want the packets. All right? The web browser wants the web browsing packets. And the system monitor, you know, they don't want it. So probably 6 out of 7, if not 7 out of 7, of those packet copies were a complete waste of time. So what we would rather do is rather than moving the data to the applications, we'd rather move the applications to the data. And that leads to the idea of running application-written filters inside the operating system kernel. Huge security problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huge security problem. Unless you're careful. And if there's one thing programming languages people learn to be, it's careful. Okay? So what you do is you choose your poison. One possibility is say, look, I'm not going to let them write their packet filter in C. I'm going to make them write it in some other language, some safe language, some language that can't segfault, that can't read page table registers, that can't take over the machine. And then what I'll do is they'll write their packet filter in a special language. I will write an interpreter. And when the packet comes in, I will have my little interpreter. Interp has type prog. That's the thing the application provided. Arrow packet. That's the thing the wire provided. Arrow bool. And if I get a true, I'll pass it back to the application. If I get a false, I'll drop the packet on the floor. I won't give it to them. Works like a charm. You do have to be careful about what if this prog doesn't terminate. right? Operating systems don't like code that runs forever. But you know what? We could take imp and toss out while loops, everything will terminate. In fact, imp without while loops runs in time proportional to the program size. Ooh, and that's pretty cool. Because that means once and for all, when I get the program, I know how long it'll take to decide if it wants a packet. So you can do this. All right. It's also very portable. If applications want to install packet filters on lots of different operating systems, or lots of different, same operating system, but different machines, architectures, versions, whatever, they just write the program once. What changes is the interpreter, perhaps, that's written in C or assembly or something like that. So it works like a charm. What's the problem? People don't like writing in your favorite language. They like writing in C. And this can be really slow. Interpreters run a lot slower than letting them actually download, you know, code to run in the kernel. Okay? So here's another possibility that gets around that second point, which is let's translate. Okay? So they still think that we're doing it this way. But really what we're doing is we're taking a prog and we're producing some, in practice, assembly, but let me write it with C. Int f takes a packet p and write some code. So when they install the packet filter, we'll go and compile from that funny program into some pretty fast code. Now we are the compiler, so we trust ourselves, okay? And then when the packet shows up, we'll just generate this code that we'll just run this code that we created when we installed the packet filter. Okay? In fact, generating C code isn't such a bad idea, because then we could just call the C compiler, forgetting for the moment that kernel calls probably should not be invoking compilers. And then that existing compiler, which has been written for 20 years by people in a different part of the company, has lots of optimizations built in. So rather than worrying about our interpreter having to be really fast, let's just rely on the existing optimization work done by this other team. Okay? The problem with this is there's actually a huge cost before you ever see the first packet. Okay, that's probably not an issue for packet filters. It can be an issue with other things. Some people don't want to pay a cost until the data arrives. We still have this unusual interface. The other thing, and I don't have it on the slide, but it always occurs to me, is if you're optimizing the interpreter, you actually understand this packet filter program. Once you've done this translation, you're just at the mercy of the C compiler, right? Maybe it does a good job, maybe it does a bad job. It really doesn't know what you're doing. Okay? Questions or comments about these two approaches? This is what we've done so far, right? This was our first two semantics, and this was our third semantics. Where we're moving in probably 2 or 3 weeks in the course is towards type systems. And type systems, in general, everyone knows what a type system is from our programming, but you can generalize them. And the way I described it last week is a type system is a filter. It takes in programs and it says yes or no. And the no, it refuses to run. Well, we could do that. We could have them write the packet filter in C, but just be really conservative about what we allow. It's like, okay, you can write any C program you want as long as it doesn't have loops, function calls, or pointers. Okay? And then they'd say, well, that's too restrictive. We go, okay, you can have loops, but the guards have to be integers, and every time through the loop, you have to increment the integer. And, oh, the integer has to be less than 1,000 or something like that. And you can go this conservative subset approach. It gives programmers a somewhat normal interface, provided they can play by your subset rules. Okay, and then you don't have to worry about actually implementing a new language, but you did have to define a new type system. Right? So there's no free lunch. Okay. What's going on here in general? I like the packet filter example because it's kind of low-level code and it feels like I know what I'm talking about. What's really going on, I can pick anything where the right thing to do is move the code to the data instead of the data to the code. And this comes up all the time, right? A query language is exactly that, right? If I want to write a database query, which makes more sense? Downloading the database to my laptop or moving my query to the database server? Well, it's a no-brainer. So what do? We define query languages, and we give them a semantics, right? And your first mock-up in your database might just interpret the query. In practice, you translate that query, into lower-level database operations. Right? It's a translated semantics. It also comes up in active networks. This is the idea that maybe the internet would work a lot faster if instead of the routers in the middle just dumbly pushing things along, if you could actually download code into the middle of the network. Because it's too expensive, quote unquote, and this is a very debatable concept. You can go take a network class to push all the data from one end of the internet to another just to find out that someone didn't want it. So it's really the same packet filter example. It's just pushing it into the network instead of just down into the OS. Okay? Questions or comments? All right, let's break for 10 minutes, and then we'll talk about program equivalence. Why don't we regroup? I actually think the next stuff we're going to go through is a little bit easier, so don't quite go to sleep yet. But I think it'll be a little less intellectual heavy lifting. I have a few mathematical equations. There's a few things left. Probably toward the end we'll get back to another interpreter for another language, so we might not get there today, and that's fine. But what I want to talk about is actually something we all use informally all the time. Okay, so this is something where, again, I just want to take something we all know. We all knew while loops, and now we know them like better than almost anyone on the planet. Okay? Now we're going to take equivalence, and we're going to learn it like better than almost anyone on the planet. And I think this is actually even more of a core concept than even programming languages, right? Being able to say, oh, these two programs are the same, or these two languages are the same, is a really deep concept. Being able to show some of the things we're going to state is... connects up to areas of math like those inductive proofs you did probably in pre-calculus. A lot of people in high school did proofs by induction there. Certainly in undergraduate computer science program it comes up. And I just want to show you where induction comes up. We're not going to go super deep on it, but what does induction have to do with two programs being the same? I will show you. And then toward the end, if we get there today, we'll start on lambda calculus, which I was saying during the break has nothing to do with calculus. Has nothing to do with Newton or Leibniz. It's this thing from the 1930s that actually explains perfectly functions, which is cool. Okay, so why do we care about code equivalence? This is me kind of getting back up on my soapbox. It's just hugely important. This is the code maintenance question, right? If you don't know that X, you know, that this program is equivalent to that one, then you don't change code that's working. Right? Now, I know a lot of times we have lots of sort of pressures not to change code that's working, but there's good reasons to make it run faster, to make it cleaner, to, you know, get rid of that cruft that the summer intern left in. And when you're doing that, every single time, you're reasoning in terms of equivalence. Right? There's issues of compatibility, both backward and forward. Right? Backward compatibility roughly amounts to, for things in the language that the old version accepted, I'm equivalent. Right? It's equivalent. That's backward compatibility using the E word. Right? Program verification, this comes up for people who actually want to prove something about their program. What you often do is you say, you break it into pieces. You would like to show that some program S has some property. Okay? And just as a way of decomposing the problem, this looks like I'm going to make it harder, but you know, it works out, trust me, is to say, well, S, oh gosh, I can't write today. S is equivalent, let me use three lines for equivalent, don't worry about it, I'm not going to use that again, to S prime. And S prime might be slower or not the way it was coded up or not what I would want to say, but it's easier to show that S prime has the property I want, like it terminates or it doesn't, you know, give away credit card numbers. So key to this is the notion of equivalence. If you ever write a compiler, and you will, any kind of optimizer, any kind of rewriter, you're talking about equivalence all the time, right? And people love to optimize by hand, in which case, instead of thinking very carefully in writing the compiler, they're thinking perhaps slightly less carefully while writing the code themselves. Okay? And the final point, and this might be lost here, but we'll get back to it later in the class, but this, it was a nice logical place to put it on the slide, is to say, showing that S is equivalent to S prime is really hard. Things aren't equivalent a lot. But if I know how it's going to be used, then I might be able to show this a little more easily. Okay? Let me show kind of an extreme example. Let's say I have some library, some API, some sequence of calls, and I might say, if no one uses the foo call, then I can do these things. Right? So So maybe I have a way to check that. I have some way to say, you know what? Don't use the foo call. Let me give you a language example. People in compilers do this all the time. We say, if people don't use reflection, then I can make these changes. This is hugely important, actually. If you have some class and you see that some field is never being used and you want to get rid of it, you always have to have this little caveat that's like, unless people use reflection, because then they can find out what fields the class has. Right? So your stronger interface might be someone doesn't use something, and that makes the equivalence question easier. Okay? It's kind of an obvious point, but it's worth saying, I guess. All right. So I've said equivalence about 75 times since the break, but what we want to do now is say, actually, what do I mean by equivalent? Right? I don't want to just wave my hands. This class is way too precise to say, and it like behaves the same. Right? What does it mean to behave the same? Well, now that we have this notion of what programs do, what they compute, we can come up with a bunch of different definitions. And you should know these all exist. A very common one, especially for program verification or in compilers or things like that, is this has two parts, equivalence, that's what we've been talking about, partial and IO. So IO equivalence, and don't just think of like printf and scanf or, you know, cout and cin, okay? Think effects, like what I write, what I read. Okay, so IO equivalence, that's a pretty nice notion. It says two programs are equivalent if given the same inputs, they produce the same outputs. Seems natural enough, right? Partial equivalence lets you cheat in one little tiny way. It says, given two programs, S1 and S2, if the input to them are the same, the output are the same, but if they don't terminate, then I'm not saying anything. Okay? Which is really nice, because otherwise, to show equivalence, you would have to show they both terminate. And that's really hard. I mean, it's impossible in theory, and it's very hard in practice. So what partial IO equivalence says is, given S1 and S2, if both terminate, okay, given the same input, if both terminate, they produce the same output. If one or both doesn't terminate, then they're equivalent. I just cheat. They are equivalent. Okay? And it skirts the issue. All right? There's a couple consequences to that cheat that aren't very pleasant. One is that this very nice imp program is equivalent to every imp program. Just chase the definition. Is this equivalent to some arbitrary S? Well, yeah, it doesn't terminate. And I said that if one of them doesn't terminate, they're equivalent. So it's equivalent to everything. Let me go further and mess with your minds a little bit more. That means that the equivalence relationship is not transitive. Here's something I like about equivalence relations. If S1 is equivalent to S2, and S2 is equivalent to S3, then S1 is equivalent to S3. That's what transitive means. And it's not true for partial IO equivalence. And this is basically why. If it were true, then everything would be equivalent to everything else, and that's a useless definition. Because S1 is equivalent to this guy, and S2 is equivalent to this guy, because everything's equivalent to this guy. But I don't really want these to be equivalent to each other necessarily. Okay? So partial IO equivalence, it comes up all the time, but it's a hack. All right? It's not really what you want. Please.
What's the value of making the exception that if one of them doesn't terminate, they're equivalent?
It's easy. I want to show two things are equivalent for all the reasons on the previous slide. And it's just too hard to reason about termination behavior.
Well, wouldn't it be more useful to say if one of them does not terminate, then they're not equivalent?
I could say if one of them doesn't terminate, then they're not equivalent. Now, to show two things, I like that, Ian. I like that avoids these issues.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, to the person trying to show two things are equivalent, it imposes the obligation of showing they terminate.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. But you know, that's exactly what total I/O equivalence is. This total versus partial, these are very generic words. When did total and partial have to do with termination behavior? Since about 71, I think. Floyd and Hoare and these guys. You know, I wish they'd picked more accurate terms, but this partial-total thing goes back about 35 years now. That partial and total, when talking about equivalence, refers to termination behavior. Okay. And this is exactly what I've basically been claiming you want, is for two things to be equivalent, then given the same input, either they both go into infinite loops, or they both terminate, and if they both terminate, they produce the same answer. Okay. That really does seem like what you want. Okay. Have to have the same termination behavior. Okay. Please.
Well, couldn't they both have infinite loops that have different I/O?
Ah. Yeah, this is, okay. Yeah, so I'm being a little sloppy on this slide by what do I mean by O? Do I mean the answer at the end, or do I mean anything that you print? And I guess I mean anything that you print. But now I have to worry about, but now two infinite loops might not be the same. One goes in a loop printing A, and one goes in a loop printing B. So now we're in a very difficult situation about basically reasoning about sort of infinite output.
Well, once you find one counterexample to the similarity...
Yeah, then they wouldn't be equivalent, absolutely. Yeah.
So you still have to look at the infinite cases. You still have to compare the output, right?
That's right. Yeah, you do. That's totally a fair point. Yeah. If we're talking about INF, we could say output is just what the ANTS variable holds at the end. Sure. And then INF is simpler, because INF doesn't have sort of real I.O.
Right, it's not infinite.
It's not infinite. That's right. Mm-hmm. It does have infinite loops, but it doesn't have infinite data. Yeah. In fact, we were talking, actually, someone at the break, yeah, it was during the break, said, you know, hey, wouldn't you really want a hash table for your heaps? Because these lists in IMP, I mean, they're really inefficient. And the answer I didn't think of at the time, and it gets back to this idea that IMP programs have finite data, is I could run over my program ahead of time and see exactly what variables exist. And then I don't even need a hash table. I could, you know, literally use an array. Right, I know exactly how big my if given an imp statement s, I know exactly how big my heap will ever possibly be. Right, it might not ever get that big because I might not get to the part that uses some variable x, but I can conservatively bound it. Just run over the program, see how many variables there are. That's how much space it uses. Okay, please.
So if you have trouble proving that something terminates, is it useful to break it down and say, well, I can't prove that this whole big contract terminates, but I can take pieces of it and prove that those pieces are equivalent?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you can definitely say, hey, I have two loops. They have sort of different guards, different increments, but the prints inside the loops are the same. So I can at least show that sort of... you know, if I have two loops that, you know, one always prints A and the other always prints A, well, now at least I just have to show the two loops execute the same number of times. I don't care how many times. I don't care if they terminate. You know, but they do have to do this, you know, be the same number of times. So I don't have to show... Right, so this is good. This is a really nice point that I didn't think about when I made the slides. Let me try to explain myself rather than just talking a mile a minute. Total I/O equivalent says if they both terminate, they produce the same output. If they both don't terminate, or they both don't terminate and they produce the same output, you can't have one terminate and not the other. But to prove total I/O equivalence, you don't have to prove termination or non-termination. Maybe you can show, and I think this is what you're saying. Well, this isn't quite what you're saying. I'm putting some words in your mouth. Given S1 and S2, I don't have to prove, hey, S1 and S2 both terminate. Or S1 and S2 both don't terminate. All right. Here's an example. Let's say I have while E. Here, let me go over here. I like this. I like this example. Program 1. While X less than Y, print F X. Print F Q. Just the strings. Okay? And my other program is while X less than Y. Sorry, maybe I better increment X so that this isn't trivial. Can't write today. Plus X. this one is printf xq plus plus x. Right, unless my C is pretty rusty, I'd say these are totally equivalent. They always produce the same output, they have the same termination behavior, yet I have no idea if they terminate or not. Depends on, well, I guess they probably always terminate for any fixed Y, but maybe not.
Yes.
Yeah, eventually.
If you made it less than or equal, they won.
Anyway, you can certainly come up with equivalent guards where I have no idea if they terminate. Okay? I like that. That's a good point. It's a nasty exam question. I would never ask that. But I bet someone else would. Whoa. Oh, cool. I learned something. Just made that whole thing smaller. Weird. Now I know what that button does. Okay. These are really coarse notions of equivalence. Okay? And even though these are the common ones, these are the sort of ones that you can actually throw these words around and people know what you mean, I just kind of point out that, you know, these are really coarse notions. And it's worth pointing out, you can have more exact notions of equivalence. You could say two programs are equivalent if they produce the exact same heap. So not just the same ants variable, not just the same, they print the same stuff, but when the program finishes executing, like, the RAM has to be the same. And that's probably too strict. But I just want to point that out as sort of a counterpoint, that these are throwing away, these are fuzzing over lots of issues, which is a good thing. Because I want to show things are equivalent. I want to be a code optimizer. I don't want to require every single bit on the machine to be the same. Or maybe I do. Okay. I also point out that in programming languages, see, you guys all decided to take my class instead of Ladner's class. And about 36 hours ago, you were regretting that decision. That whole class is about saying, you know what? Exponential algorithms are not equivalent to linear algorithms. Right? They're just not. Well, in programming languages, they are. Right? If for all inputs, you produce the same answer, you have the same termination behavior, you're equivalent. And that's the difference between my class and Richard's class. Okay? Is he's teasing out those distinctions, and I'm fuzzing them over. Okay? And again, from a code optimizer perspective, that's a good thing, because I would love to take an exponential algorithm and make it linear. And I want to be allowed to do that and say I've produced an equivalent program. Okay? So now you know the difference between complexity and programming languages. We could go even more strict. We could go more strict than saying you have to have the same complexity. We could say you have to be syntactically the same. So two programs are equivalent, maybe only if they're like only differ in white space. Right? Like, or they only differ in comments. Or maybe you're allowed to rename your variables as long as you do it consistently. Okay? So that is an even stricter notion of equivalence. And since I kind of told you syntax was boring, I kind of have to tell you that syntactic equivalence is boring. But I just want to point you out that the whole point here is that, you know, when you toss around words like equivalence, you should, when someone does that, you know, you should push back. What do you mean by equivalent? And not just to be obnoxious, it really does matter. Okay? Let me go on a slight digression here and point out that there's a security connection here, which is that if your equivalence notion is too fuzzy, you end up thinking things are equivalent that the attacker does not. Okay? A common way, this is actually super cool, spooky sort of stuff, they can actually figure out like what your DES password is by basically analyzing the radiation coming off your laptop while you're doing DES encryption. Okay? And that's because the way the hardware does the encryption is it says, well, this is equivalent to that. I'll always get the same bits out. But depending on your key, you exhibit different power radiation. Okay? Timing channels are basically the same thing. I just said on the previous slide, I want two things that take different amounts of time to run to be equivalent. Someone can tell the difference. Okay? On the other hand, from a non-security perspective, as a compiler writer, I absolutely need flexibility to rewrite code. Okay? So, the stuff matters, and you have to think carefully about it. We could talk about this for hours. And I recommend we not. Okay. There's another aspect of equivalence. So this was equivalence, the what. All right. What do we mean by two? What do we mean by behave the same? At what granularity are we looking at results? There's another question for code equivalence, which is where. And I'm just going to give you two definitions of where, one which is far, far more useful than the other. Okay. One notion of equivalent is that S1 and S2 are equivalent as whole programs. Okay. S1 and S2 are equivalent if you run them on the empty heap, read out the answer, and you get the same thing. Okay? That's a notion of equivalence, where the where means as the argument to interpret prog. There's a tougher notion of equivalence, which is usually called contextual equivalence, because it says in any context, not just this outermost context, but in any context, they're equivalent, which basically means that for S1 and S2 to be equivalent, you're allowed to go anywhere into the abstract syntax tree of your program, find an S1, and replace it, I have to draw the same tree here, with an S2. And only if that holds are they equivalent. Does that difference make sense informally? Okay. I'm kind of mathy, so let me show it to you formally. Okay. This is kind of hard. Don't worry, too. This is not on the homework. But I think it's nice that if you're going to define contextual equivalence, that you not wave your hands and have to draw pictures like this. So what we do is we want to come up with the definition of what it means to be a context. What do I mean? Where are you allowed to substitute S1 for S2? And to keep the example smaller, I switch to expressions. So let's talk about E1 and E2. Okay. So what I want to do informally is I want to say what a context is. It's just like I had. It's some subtree down to the leaf. So I have a bunch of trees, and I'm saying, you know, I have some tree, and I'm saying if some part of it is E1, then the context is the rest of it. It's this part, right? It's the whole rest of the tree. And what I'm saying is that E1 and E2 are equivalent, meaning that given this context, this fat part, well, there's like a hole here. The context is the part without the E1. And what I want to say is I can plug in the E1, or I can plug in the E2, and it doesn't matter which. Okay? That's what I'm saying informally. This is what I'm saying formally. This is my definition of trees with holes. So this is what a hole looks like. So one kind of tree with a hole is just a hole. Another kind of tree with a hole is something where I have a plus, I have some expression over on the right, and over on the left I have some tree with a hole in it somewhere. Okay? So C stands for tree with exactly one hole. And I would argue that anything created by this BNF definition is a tree with exactly one hole in it. Okay? So that's half the being really, really pedantic and turning this picture into a data type. And we could absolutely do this in Camel. Okay? So given this definition of context, now I have trees with holes in them. Now I have to come up with a definition of what it means to fill the hole. How do I fill the hole? Well, I write a function that takes a context and an expression and returns an expression. The context is the thing with a hole. This is the thing I'm putting in the hole. And once I've plugged the hole, I have some big expression. And here's the cases of the definition. And they're actually all really boring. It says to fill the hole where the whole thing is a hole, you just get the expression. Otherwise, you recur. This is a different meta language. I kind of wish at the moment I had done this in Camel. I'm writing my function, this meta function, as these like green brackets. But the bottom line is, contexts are things with a hole. This is the function that goes and plugs the hole in with something. And now I have sort of what I need to talk about contextual equivalence. Questions? All right. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you, I'm going to end up showing you two really obvious theorems, but you'll see how they're stated, and that's a nice thing. And then we'll go on from there. Okay, but first I'm going to show you a really dumb theorem, even dumber than our dumb theorems. This is the really dumb theorem. Okay, so the really dumb theorem, all right, is what I really want to say is that E plus E is the same as 2 times E. But I want to do this carefully, because hopefully I've convinced you that equivalence is something that should be talked about carefully. So here's my crack at it. I want to say, for all heaps H and expressions E, let's pick a language semantics to talk about equivalence. How about our large step operational semantics? So for any H and any E, if I call interp E large on H and plus EE, I'll get I, if and only if, calling interp large on H and times E2 gives me I. Okay? All I've done is state the theorem. Right? I've taken the intuitive notion that E plus E and 2 times E are the same, and I've stated it. But I haven't done it with contexts. This is for the whole program. So if my whole expression is plus EE and I get I, then if I can just as well make my whole expression times E2. Okay? Proving this, if you will, is actually really simple. Okay? What you do is you take your definition of interp E large and you look at it. And you say, well, it looks like this. It says, if you have a plus E2, then you end up doing the two recursive calls and adding them. And if you have a times, you do the two recursive calls and you multiply them. And then you just look at this guy and you say, well, if I call it on E, I'm going to get some J. And if I call it on 2, I'm going to get 2, and I'm going to get J times 2. And up here, I have E and E, so I'm going to get J and J. And now I just appeal to the fact that in camel, see, these are imps plus and times. And in camel, this is camels plus and times. And I have to just say that, you know, unless I want to have a new theorem that says these are equivalent in camel. But eventually, I have to just take that these things work. Okay? The details of this are not important. What's important, and really the whole point of contextual equivalence, is that this is really dumb because it's not really what I want to say. What I really want to say, Fred, I got an unhandled exception. Oh, maybe it won't crash. Nope, I lost it. All right.
Passed out.
Yeah, I know. That's why you're sitting there.
So while you're fixing that,
please.
Is this just a fancy way of saying that E has no state?
Yeah, it's saying more than that. But I like that because in the sense if E could have effects, then you're absolutely right that executing E once versus executing E twice could make a huge difference. So I guess I'm just splitting hairs. I like your comment, and then because I'm trying to be so precise here, I'm going to split hairs and say, well, it says more than that. Okay? Okay. I won't touch anything until you say the word. It's saying more than that. It's saying E plus E can be replaced with 2 times E for your outermost program. But I agree with you that that's because, in part, E has no effects. It's also because of a certain property of camel mathematics. So while we're waiting, the thing I want to point out here, if you look at the previous slide, and if you don't have it, that's fine. Remember, we did this whole thing of being able to talk about any subtree, right? Any subtree. And then we went ahead and stated a theorem that didn't do that. So on the next slide, as soon as I'm allowed to show it to you, we're going to state a more complicated theorem that's going to talk about any subtree, and it's going to use our definition of contexts. Okay? And it looks like we're good to go.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right. That's where we were. Okay. And that was an easy proof. It's sort of very direct. When we go to contexts, our theorem is more complicated, and it uses that funny function of plugging the hole I just talked about. Now our theorem says, for all expressions H and expressions E, that's what we had before. Switch back to red. And all context C, all trees with holes in them, if E1 is plugging the hole with this guy, and E2 is plugging the hole with this guy, then E1 and E2 are still equivalent. See what we've done? Right? We've said I can go in anywhere I want. Any C, any expression with a hole in it. I can replace any expression that's E1 with E2, any E2 with E1, and I get the same thing for my whole program. Okay? And that's the key difference. And for those of you who are a little more interested in the mathematics or the connection to induction, what's going on here, is when I wanted to prove my previous theorem, it was just sort of direct. I just looked at interp E large and I was done. I can't just look at interp E large now because I don't know what my context is. Right? I don't just have two programs. I have an infinite number of pairs of programs. For every possible C, there's an E1 and an E2. On the previous slide, I just had plus EE and times E2. Now I have this infinite pair. Okay? So if I'm going to prove this equivalence, I don't have time to go through each element of this infinite set. So I have to organize it somehow. And the way I organize it is by height. So I start with the small expressions and I move on to the larger ones. So the base case is when my context, my whole is the whole expression. And that is the previous theorem. The simplest case is when the context is so boring that my whole program is either plus E, comma E, or times E, comma 2. Okay? That's the most boring case. In the other cases, I have a taller tree. Maybe, turns out there's four cases. One, two, three, four. Here's what one of them looks like. It looks like I have a plus, I have an E, and I have some smaller context over here. Okay? And so this height is bigger than this height. And if you believe in induction, you learn that that means that that C prime filled with the hole with E1 and C prime filled with E2, the theorem will hold. And now I have to go from there to showing that the whole tree with E1 and E2, the theorem holds. And it turns out these four cases are all very, very similar. It's just a matter of whether you have a plus or a times up here and whether your C prime is on the left or on the right. Okay? And I don't want to focus on that too much. I do think there's this connection between contextual equivalence and this inductive argument that I have to talk about all possible places where the expressions could go. And the way to organize that argument is to start with the smaller context and proceed to the larger ones. And if that makes intuitive sense, and you believe me that there's sort of a deep mathematics underneath it, I'm willing to call it a success. Okay? All right. And I think that's the moral. Okay, yeah. So the moral is not that this is an interesting theorem. Okay, kind of the most negative word I could think of for this theorem is pedantic. Right? It's totally obvious. It's obvious because E has no effect. But the structure of the argument is much, much more interesting. The fact that even to state the theorem, we needed this pretty careful definition of what it means to replace some E1 with an E2. Then we had a proof that used induction over the height of those contexts, and we ended up with a much more interesting theorem. Okay, it was still a dumb theorem. But if you compare these two theorems, this one is really dumb. And this one is only dumb because E plus E and E times 2 is like, third grade arithmetic. Okay? It has a really interesting part, and that's the C part. Okay? Questions? Comments? All right. Wanted to show you one other example. I'm thinking about skipping this. Let me just tell you what's in there. Okay? I wanted to talk about another obvious thing about IMP, And this is actually true in C also. Okay, so here's an example that's true. The sequence operator is associative. So there's another funny math term. What I mean is that if you wrote S1 semicolon S2 semicolon S3, you could have just as well written S1 semicolon S2 semicolon S3. Where by semicolon I mean seek if you're in abstract syntax land, S-E-Q. Okay? Again, a totally obvious thing. And not so hard to state the theorem. I mean, you need some context, maybe, which I seem to have totally forgotten. Let's see. Okay. But what I want to do in my large step semantics is, again, basically just lay it out and say that this guy returns an H prime if and only if the other guy can return the same H prime. And then, and this is kind of an interesting point, getting back to partial versus total equivalence, if one guy can go into an infinite loop, then I need the other guy to be able to go into an infinite loop. Now, I split these two cases out. I didn't actually have to do it. And it gets back to something that is kind of obvious about IMP and is not true in most programming languages. IMP's deterministic, right? If you call interp s large on some heap in some statement, there's only one possible behavior. Okay, it never flips coins. It never asks the user for input. It never calls out to some external library. You get back one particular answer, or zero if you go into an infinite loop. But the way I stated this theorem, I didn't actually assume that determinism property. I just said, well, it's maybe, it turns out not to be true, but in my imaginary mathematical head, I was saying, you know what? Maybe when you call interp s large on a heap and a statement, you can get different answers on different days of the week. That's okay for equivalence, as long as every possible answer for this program is a possible answer for this program, and vice versa. Okay? So equivalence does not require determinism, and determinism does not require equivalence. They're just words. All right. People are sufficiently bored by this, I'm not surprised. Equivalence is a really cool notion, but for IMP, it's really boring. Okay? So let me move on and say, we've been dealing with code equivalence. I have one language, IMP with a large step operational interpreter, and I had some examples of when two pieces of code in that language were equivalent. Okay? Now what I want to do is kind of move the next level up. I'm not going to talk about code equivalence on the next slide. I'm going to talk about language equivalence. This is an even harder thing to show. It's kind of code equivalence in the meta language. Forget I just said that. Here's two semantics. Are they equivalent? Now, I've already stated for you that our three semantics are equivalent, and that's an interesting fact. I'm not going to prove it. Okay? But there are other times where this comes up in life besides, you know, hey, we did three semantics. Are they the same? Another thing that we do all the time when we write compilers or interpreters is we try to throw out extra rules. We hate extra rules. Extra rules is more for Ben to grade. It's more for you to write. It's more places for security bugs. So we want like the minimal number of rules possible. Okay? Now, it turns out in my IMP interpreters, I didn't exactly screw it up. Right? I already had the minimal number of rules. So let me give you a silly example. Let's suppose that in our interpreter we had put this rule in. Okay? Well, we don't need it. Right? We can just leave it out. We already have a perfectly fine rule that takes an E1 and an E2. And it just recursively computes. And if E2 is 0, then it'll get back 0. That's fine. It'll multiply them together, and we'll get 0. Okay? So the proof would be we have a language that has this rule, and we have a language that doesn't have this rule, and they're equivalent. Okay? So that's a simpler example. These are very hard proofs. These are very easy proofs. Okay? But they're nonetheless important, and they're an example of language equivalence. In the real world, language equivalence basically doesn't exist, but oh, we wish it did. Okay, I mentioned this once before, let me do it again. Backward compatibility. Here is a false theorem. Okay? But it's a design goal. Right? Theorems that are false, you know, that's what you call it, right? A false theorem is a design goal. Right? You know. You didn't need it, but you know, you tried. Right? So Java 1.5 and Java 1.4 are equivalent on all 1.4 programs. Okay? So I qualified it. They're not exactly the same language. If they were exactly the same language, there wouldn't be a Java 1.5. But we could say that, well, Java 1.5 is just a superset. That's basically what backward compatibility is. Okay? Now, no one ever gets this for languages. If anything, you always toss in keywords. Right? One of the reasons C++ is not actually backward compatible with C is in C you can have a variable named new, N-E-W, and in C++ you can't. So if anyone tells you that C++ is backward compatible to C, they're wrong. But this comes up all the time, and so we always give allowances for keywords. Okay, we always say, if you rename your variables. Okay, and even then, it tends not to be true. And I know Ben was telling me, I don't know an example offhand, but I know this is false here. There's certain things they changed.
I don't know offhand.
Yeah, but you know what? They just further qualify it. And certainly, you know, what I would call sophomore level Java, it's true. Right? Within some sort of core part of the language, it's absolutely true. And they worked pretty hard at it. They didn't want to go in and change the definition of method call. That wasn't their goal. And they worked pretty hard that even though the compilers are fundamentally different, I imagine, I have no idea. I just picked Java, you know, replaced this with C++, you know.
Another example, people in this class are running four different versions of OCaml.
Yeah. There are four, for three different operating systems and Seminole and whatever, yeah. So, you know, there we would like to actually have language equivalents. I think this backward compatibility is kind of interesting because what you do when you move from version to version of the language as opposed to the compiler is you do typically change the language. Not always, but usually. But you do go for this, like, but the parts I didn't change behave the same. Right? And people work pretty hard to talk about what that means. So we've done a lot of equivalence. We've done code equivalence. We did language equivalence. Now what I want to do is go back to code equivalence. Sorry to jump around a little bit, but we're actually I want to do it for CAML. Okay? Just because we're using CAML, but I'll point out where things are the same in other languages, you know. So we've actually done this already too. So, you know, there's some repetition in the course. I think it's nice for learning. One notion of equivalence is syntactic sugar. So I told you in lecture one that any time you see this, you could just rewrite it as that. Well, now we know that if I wanted to use fancy four-syllable words, I could have said that the thing on the left is contextually total I/O equivalent to the thing on the right. No matter where you are in your program, you can replace this with this. The entire program will behave the same, where by behave the same, I mean you haven't changed the termination behavior, you haven't changed what gets outputted, you haven't changed what gets returned from a function. So syntactic sugar is just, it's this total I/O contextual equivalence, and I guess syntactic sugar is not something that, to my knowledge, has a precise definition, but it's roughly macro expansion. It's roughly, notice, I didn't actually look at what E1, E2, and E3 were. Okay? And just to remind you, here's another example I already showed you. Showed you that this thing on the left is sugar for this thing on the right. Something I didn't bother showing you, because it's actually true in pretty much every programming language, is that E1 and E2 is sugar for this conditional expression. If you are in C, C++, Java, C# have question mark colon? I presume it does. This would just be E1 question mark E2 colon false. Okay? So that's a very common one. Compilers love this stuff because it makes writing your compiler easier. You don't have to have anything for %&. You just have a pass in your compiler that just gets rid of all the sugar. And then what you actually have to compile is a smaller language. Okay? Cool. So now what we're going to do is we're going to motivate the next part of the course by trying to do something more interesting for CAML equivalences than this. I mean, this stuff's boring. I mean, it's great to know. It helps you learn the language. But from an equivalence standpoint, it's like, well, yeah, obviously. Okay? So I'm going to talk about three function equivalences, three ways that two functions could be equivalent, and I'm going to get all three definitions wrong, but we'll fix it next time. And they'll be intuitively right. They won't be far off. They'll be close. Okay? And these three are like, I mean, these are huge. They even have fancy theory names, named after Greek letters, believe it or not. So we have three function equivalences. The first one I like to call systematic renaming. people who like obscure Greek letters call it alpha equivalence. Okay? And here's what it is. It's so obvious, but it's worth talking about because I'm actually going to get it wrong. This function is equivalent to this one, where E2 is just like E1. The function body is like the other function body, with all the x's replaced by y. Super high level. You can go in, you can change the argument name of a function, you can change all the uses of the argument, and you come up with something that's total I/O contextual equivalent. Okay? And it turns out that is true in C, but it's not true in Java or C++ or C# or ML. Anyone want to take a stab at why? Yeah.
Because you're covering, you may be covering other variables with similar names.
Yeah. What if there's some Y outside of this that's still in scope? Right? You can't switch, because see, E1 then already has Y's. And those Y's are supposed to be these outer ones. Right? But now, after this change, those Y's are still going to be there. We changed the X's to Y's. Any Y's that were already there are still Y's. What I meant by this working in C is, in C there wouldn't be any Y's. Oh, there would be globals. Okay, doesn't work in C either. Alright? So, I stand corrected. I knew I shouldn't have said that. Okay. So that's basically why it's wrong. We'll fix it next time. We'll come up with a much more precise definition. But what I like about this example is, look, this is close. It's wrong, that's why we take programming language classes. Even though it's not, you know, a moment's reflection, you saw why it was wrong. But we would like to fix it. And after we fix it, we'd like to know that we're done. Right? We don't want to like fix it and find out we're still wrong. So you take a class and you find out that, yeah, a couple fixes and you're done. Okay? You want this property in your language. You want to be able to locally rename variables and know that you're done. Although you certainly have to be aware of this issue that you better pick some Y that is not already being used in E1. Okay. That's function equivalence 1 of 3, and it's the boring one. Okay? Here's a more interesting one. If I have some application, I have some function applied to some expression, then that could be the same as take this body and replace all the x's with E2. Okay? So, for example, very simple example, instead of having fun x, x plus x applied to 3, I instead have 3 plus 3. Okay? I claim that this and this are total I/O contextual equivalent. In fact, they're both total I/O contextual equivalent to 6. Right? You can't tell whether I wrote 6 or I wrote this. Okay, but that's not the point. I'm focusing on these two. Okay? This is like eager function application or compile time application or, you know, I don't know, you can call it whatever you want. It's don't use a function, just plug in the argument everywhere you had an X. Okay? And it's wrong too. Okay? It's definitely wrong in a language with sort of mutation. If E2 is plus plus X, it matters a whole lot how many times I execute it. And in this version, I execute it once. And in this version, I execute it twice. And I actually know enough about the C standard to know that when I say it executes it twice, that's what I would expect, not what the standard guarantees. But that's a story not for this class. Okay. That's definitely an issue. It turns out that even if I were pure, and what I mean by pure is no assignment, no mutation, the part of camel we have seen, it's still wrong. It has to do with termination. Anyone have an example where two things are not equivalent by this rule? It has something to do with an infinite loop. It's tricky.
For recursive calls of some sort?
It's tricky because you're trying to do something far more complicated than the answer. Yeah, so that's not it, but that's what I would think.
Well, you can redefine the environment in E2 having the same problem as the first as alpha equivalents.
Yeah, there's definitely an alpha issue. That's true. There's a renaming issue, a variable issue. So that's true. I grant you that. Separate from that. I'll give you a hint. E2 is the infinite loop.
In one of them, you have to evaluate E2 before you pass it in.
Yeah.
In the other, you could have E2 in there, but might never get to evaluate it because some if isn't true.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll simplify your answer in a minute, but I like your answer because it's more realistic than my simpler one. So fun x, if blah, then x else 0 applied to infinite loop. Pardon the bad handwriting. This version goes into an infinite loop. Always, because we evaluate arguments before we call the function. But on the other half of my alleged equivalence, I have if blank then infinite loop else 0. And that might terminate. Depends what I put in the blank. All right? That's exactly what we get to Bob, right? Yeah, that's exactly what Bob was suggesting. All right? People see that he has successfully broken my alleged rule. All right. Now let me show you the simple example. Just pick an E1 that doesn't actually use x. All right. So my simple example is fun x arrow 0 infinite loop. Same exact problem. I claimed that that was equivalent to 0, and it is definitely not. Because one terminates and returns 0, and the other goes into an infinite loop. Okay, so this stuff's fun. It's easy to confuse your managers, and I mean, I could have presented these as rules, and you all would have gone home and gotten some sleep, and seen your family, and probably not realize that these are totally busted rules. Okay, but we'll revisit them and we'll fix them, and we'll have to talk about ANDed terminates and stuff like that. Okay, rule number 3. This is one that's kind of an MLism. It's a little more interesting because it has to do with higher order functions, but I like it a lot. So it's called eta equivalence. Oh, the last one is beta, in case I forgot to mention the Greek letter. I guess it's on the slide. This is eta, which is this one. Beta is that one. Alpha is that one. So one thing I have in common with the members of campus that belong to fraternities is we both know all the Greek letters. This is unnecessary function wrapping, is kind of the informal name for it. So I claim that under all these same rules, E1, I guess I wrote E1, is pure, it terminates, I don't have these variable issues. This guy is equivalent to this guy. Okay? That looks kind of weird. It looks kind of backwards. Let me show you an example. Suppose I had this code, all right? We're all kind of new to map, all right? So we say, okay, I have map, I have some list. Remember, map applies the same function to every element of the list. It produces a new list, okay? So what function do I pass? Some function that takes an x and applies f to x, okay? I claim I could have just done this, okay? F is already something that takes something and produces an answer. What's the point of wrapping it with this wrapper function that takes in some argument and immediately passes it on to f? The answer is mostly that there's no point. Right? And definitely, when Ben sees this on your homework, with a very nice small font but perhaps red pen, suggests that this would be a more stylistic, idiomatic, simpler way of saying the same thing. But a lot of the same issues come up. If I replace f with infinite loop, okay, and list is the empty list, You gotta be kind of clever with this stuff. Then this one won't terminate. And this one will. Because map on the empty list never calls its function. Okay. I'm using infinite loop because I have a pure language. But if you go to an impure language, a language that you know, has effects, like prints things, this comes up even more. Right? So if this guy could say, you know, print hello and then become a function, well, then this version will print it once, and this version will print it once for every element in the list, which could be fewer times, same number of times, or more times, because lists can have any length that you want. Okay. One final point, and it's on here on the slide. E1 better not actually use x. This gets back to kind of our variable issues. I can't just strip off some x that's actually being used here. I can only strip it off if it's not being used, like it is in this example here. Okay? So I think I covered the three caveats. It has to be pure, can't print or do something like that. It has to terminate, or I have an issue, for example, with the empty list, and it can't use x, or whatever x was in here is now being defined somewhere it shouldn't be.
So that f really is a function, or is an expression that returns a function.
That's right.
So, I mean, because if it were just a reference to a function, then it would have the same behavior, right?
That's right. Yeah. And what'll happen, the reason why this worked, of course, I didn't show you a whole program here. Somewhere up higher, I have some let, you know, f equal dot, dot, dot. And this was already evaluated. That's the rule of let. It's evaluated to a value, right? And so this is already a value. It's going to terminate. It's already terminated. It's already printed whatever it's going to print. When I go to use it here, all I do is look it up. So looking, it turns out in CAML, and I'm going to say this is true in most other languages I can think of, looking up a variable, writing f, can't cause printing, infinite loops, throwing exceptions, etc. Okay? I think that's true. Reading fields, not the case, stuff like that. But for reading variables, I think I'm on pretty solid ground here. It has all these nice properties. It doesn't have effects. It doesn't go into infinite loops, and so on.
So the one on the left doesn't terminate. I mean, sorry, terminates.
Mm-hmm.
The one on the right might not terminate because you have to evaluate that function.
Nope.
To return a function?
This function is done. It's a value too. It's just a more complicated value than f. It's another level of function around it.
But you have to evaluate the thing in parentheses.
This is a value.
Or you just run the map, right?
Yep. You do have to evaluate this guy, just like you have to evaluate this guy, but both are trivial. This because it's just a variable and you look it up, and this because it's a function. You don't actually evaluate the function body yet. After all, you don't have an argument yet.
Right, but that thing in parentheses, I guess, could be, well...
Oh, yeah, if I change the example, I would say, yes.
Oh, that's right. So why, I guess I don't quite understand then why that thing on the left wouldn't terminate. Why would Matt ever invoke F on an empty list in that first syntax?
Okay. The example here is a correct example. I think I confused, I said too much without changing what was on the slide.
Okay.
Let me show you an example where they're not equivalent.
If that were an expression, then
exactly.
It would be correct.
Okay. If f were an expression, perhaps an infinite loop.
Right.
Exactly. If f is a variable, this is an absolutely correct example. Yep. Good. Okay. Good. I think we're doing really well here. All right. So where are we? This was a tough conversation. All right. This was a tough conversation, and not just because it was in CAML. I could have done this with C++ and said, when is this method equivalent to this other method? When can I change the name of an argument? When can I sort of do the method call eagerly replacing the argument with the body? When can I remove a function wrapper? Okay, it's tough stuff to talk about. The definitions were wrong. We will fix them. They're not that hard to fix. We've covered most of it, but how do we know we're done? Right? So what I want to do is I want to say, you know what? We did while loops really carefully. And functions are harder than while loops, so they're worth doing really carefully. And that's the whole next part of the course. And we'll get to really cool stuff after that. But functions are really cool. We did it with while loops because they're easy. Now we're going to do it with functions because they're cool. Then we'll do even more cool stuff. We'll do stuff you've never seen, like continuations. Okay? So what I want to do, and this is probably all we'll get through today, and that's fine, is I'm going to try, and it won't work, to add functions to imp. I'm going to try to cheat. Right? I'm going to try to just say, oh, functions are just like you assign to a variable and then you do the function body. And it's not going to work, and I think it'll be illuminating to see why it doesn't work. And that will motivate throwing away imp. We'll actually be done with it, modulo problem one on the homework, and we'll go to a completely new language that has functions from the beginning. So that's what we're going to do now. We're going to try to add functions to imp. Okay? That's our goal for the next 20 minutes. Okay? So here's my attempt, my first attempt, actually. Okay. So let me not change expressions. Let me add to my statements a function call. Okay. What does a function call have? It has what function you're calling and what the argument is. So all my functions will just take one argument. It's hard enough that way. Okay. We could change this to a string star exp list, and then we would have a list of arguments. But I'm keeping it simple. Okay? So a new kind of statement is a function call, but how do I define functions? Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say my program, I'm going to have a new thing. I used to just have expressions and statements, and the statement was a program. But things are more complicated now. Now I'm going to have some function definitions and a statement. And what's a function definition? It's a name of a function, then a name of an argument, and then a body. And I'm going to have a list of those. Okay, so my whole program is now, function, 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 and then a statement. That's very much like C, except that last statement has to be in something called main. Right? Okay? So I just didn't write main. Right? I could have. Right? I could have made my whole program a list of functions and said the last function is initially called and it's called with zero. Okay? I just, kind of separated out main here. Okay? So that's what I've got. And so what I'm going to do basically is my interpreter, it used to take just a heap and a statement. Now it's also going to take the functions that are defined. I'm going to ignore those functions in every case that I used to have. They're all totally unchanged. And now I have one new case for my one new kind of statement, which is a call. Questions? All right. This is why imp is useful. We can start with it and we can add things. Okay? So, a call, this is the name of the function, and this is the argument I want to pass to it. So in a more conventional language, maybe you would write it like this. Okay? All right. So, first thing I have to do is I have to look up the function. Just like we were talking about with the heap, you would actually use a hash table, or if you compiled this to assembly, you would just have a code pointer. But we have a list, so I will just look it up. And it turns out, you may as well know, there's a very nice function built into the list library that I could have used for heaps. It's called list.asoc. It does exactly what I want. It takes the string, and it takes the list, and it returns the appropriate string star statement. So that's going to give me the name of the argument and the body. And I'm going to need those things, so I'm using a little fancy pattern here just to get the parts of the tuple. That's the argument and the body. So all I did here was look up the function. Okay? Now that I've looked up the function, I need to do the function call. And here's where I'm going to try to get away with doing something cheap. All right? I'm just going to rewrite what was a call to basically this. A sequence of assign e to the argument, and then execute the body. Okay? That is a definite. It's an interpreter. OCaml type checks it. I can pass it a program. The program runs. Okay? Does anyone want to take a stab at why this is a terrible idea?
Well, yeah, go ahead. A function can be used as part of an expression, can be an expression also.
Yeah, I could have defined it that way. I mean, certainly, but yeah. certainly if I want to do camel, I'm being very restrictive, saying that function calls can only be statement. Yeah, go ahead.
Modifying the heap.
Yes.
Yeah. This is, I'm saying that calling a function whose argument is named arg is by definition modifying the global variable arg. Now I can define that. I'm the one making up the language. But this is not what functions do. Right? So for example, if I had some function that said, sorry, this is kind of imp concrete. I just kind of made up syntax as I went. If I have some function that takes x and returns 37, then I claim that what we want is that if I run this program, assign 2 to x, call f with 3, assign x to ants, I want ants to hold 2. Right? That's how it works in C, Java, Camel, C++, C#. Right? But according to my interpreter, you get 3. Here's what I like even less. If I change this to y, now I get 2 again. And I kind of said the whole nice thing about functions is you can choose your local variable names locally. And that's just not true given my previous definition.
I was actually thinking of something slightly different,
uh-huh.
which is that if you have an assignment in your body
uh-huh.
that's unrelated to the inputs,
uh-huh.
that assignment modifies the heap for statements outside that function body
right.
subsequently.
Yeah, I think you're getting at why my next attempt doesn't work. I think this one doesn't work either. Okay, certainly this is definitely a problem. Okay, I'm going to fix this one. I think your problem will still be there. Okay, it's a little harder for you to explain it because you didn't get to prepare PowerPoint slides ahead of time. But I think I understand what you're saying. Okay, so I'm going to try to fix this. I'm going to push further and try to fix this. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, every time I go to do a function call, I'm going to write then, and this is a total cheat, this makes no sense except I can implement it in Camel. I'm going to change this. Oh no, I know what I'm going to do. Sorry. Well, let me just show you what I'm going to do. Sorry, it's too hard to explain. I am going to assume some helper function that gives me some fresh variable name that's never been used before and will never be used again. Okay, it's got some counter, right? It's malloc. It says, give me some fresh name that's never going to be used again. Okay? Then what I'm going to do, so I'm going to turn my function call into make a fresh thing, call it y. Then, whatever the global arg was, remember, arg is the thing I'm worried about clobbering. That was the problem with my previous approach. Save arg in this super safe space. Now clobber arg just like I did before. Execute body just like I did before. But then after the function call is over, go to my super safe place and set arg back to what it was. Pretty clever, huh? This is going to fix my previous problem. So the function call turned x from 2 to 3. But I very cleverly saved the 2 in a safe place. And after the call, I'll take that 2 and I'll put it back where it belongs. Okay? That's the whole idea. You don't actually have to look at the camel in this code, but this is the camel code that does the same thing. Okay? This is a sequence of 4 things, 3 of which are assignments. This is a sequence of 4 things, 3 of which are assignments. So this is still broken, but it actually took me a while to see why. I kind of thought this almost might work. Okay. This is the same translation. I just copied it from the previous slide. First of all, fresh is a total hack. I mean, you know, this is just, you know, not a good idea. But suppose it were okay. But really the problem is we just moved body. That body of that function used to be up in some other place. All right? What if it has variables? Okay. What if it has a global variable named arg, or a local thing, or I'm not explaining myself well, but you're not supposed to move this guy. It doesn't work in a functional language. It doesn't work in an object-oriented language, right? Back where he was defined, there were some fields that were in scope. There were some other bindings. You can't just pick up code and move it, right? It changes the meaning. You can't take some arbitrary statement that was defined up in some other function somewhere and plop it down here and expect it to behave the same way. It just doesn't work. Okay? Does that capture what you're saying, or should we give another try?
Well, yeah, it depends upon... That's the input to the body.
Yeah.
And I was thinking the output of the body could have been just completely messed up your environment.
Oh, right.
That's the last bullet down there. If you access a global variable recursively, you're going to...
Ah, the body calls a function. Ah, yes.
Well, like, it just says equals 2.
Yeah. Yeah, x and equals 2, and then now x around, is still 2.
It doesn't matter what the argument is. It's just... It's redefining x wherever you invoke that body.
Right, right. So I did move body, and yeah, I see how you're talking about the outputs. I like that.
So the heap has changed. The global heap.
Yeah. Right. And I guess I didn't get to this point, which is not what he was saying, not what I was saying. So Ben's reminding me. I didn't actually say this thing on the slide. Even in C, all right, so body is some function whose argument is arg. So what we did is we assigned the global arg to hold E. And then over here, we're going to take the global arg and make it hold Y instead. We're going to revert it back to its old value. And the reason why we thought we could get away with this is because we're like, well, inside of body, arg is the local variable, and we want it to see E. But what if it calls another function? That other function is not supposed to see arg holding E. That other function is supposed to see the global arg. It's supposed to see arg holding whatever it held before. And it won't. And if that doesn't make sense, I know it's 10 after 9. Yeah. But believe me, this just ain't going to work. Okay? You can play around with this all day long. And, you know, probably now is not the time you feel like doing it. And it's just not going to work. Okay? And the reason why it's not going to work is functions are not syntactic sugar for assigning the global variables. They're just not. When you have functions and function calls, you kind of need a stack, or you need local variables, or you need something. You can't just have, you know, global variables x, y, and z, and, you know, say, oh, well, I'll change it to this, and I'll change it back later. It's always going to be wrong. Okay? So that's why I'm not going to take imp and toss in, like, some new thing. Or try to hack it up with assignments. Instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to add in functions as their own thing, and then while I'm at it, I'm just going to drop everything else. Okay? So we're going to throw away imp. We're actually done with imp. We're giving up on imp, right? And what we're going to do is we're going to grab this thing that actually comes straight out of the 1930s. It was the Great Depression, but they came up with a really cool logic that happens to model programming languages really well. And it's called the lambda calculus. And let me just tell you what it is. And obviously, next time we'll start with it again. This is the whole language. This is the syntax of it. Okay. And as far as the syntax, it's really just this first thing. Here I'm just defining what the final things are. So the entire language has variables, but like an ML and unlike an imp, you can't assign to them. Okay. It has functions. For traditional reasons, because it's what Church did in the 30s, they used the Greek letter lambda and a dot. But you should absolutely think of this as this. Okay? It's just fun becomes lambda and hyphen right angle becomes dot. And you have function application, which looks exactly like in Camel. It's just juxtaposition. Okay? That's the whole language. The only thing you get to do in your program is write down variables, write down function definitions, and write down function applications. We will later add more things to this to make it a little easier to understand what we're doing, but we won't need to for quite a while. Okay? So now that we have this language, we can ask ourselves, this is what we were trying to do in Camel and what we tried very badly to do in Imp, we can try to say, what does it really mean to do a function call? And the answer is, or one answer, the answer we will pursue for now, is what it means is to substitute the argument for the bound variable. What do I mean by that? I mean, if you have lambda x dot e1, and then you have e2, I'm going to define the meaning of function call to be take e1, replace all the x's with e2, and you're done. Now, we tried this once before. We decided there were huge problems. We will eventually come back to substitution and get this right. But for now, we're just going to say, and we got it right. Okay. So what I have here, and we'll go through this next time, is three examples of what this substitution does, why this is function application. And then I'm two slides away from a large step interpreter for this language that's going to use substitution as a little helper routine. And we'll see that we actually do have a programming language, even though it looks like something far too simple to be good for anything. Okay, questions? All right. It's 9:13. I think that's plenty. I'll be able to hang around for a few minutes, and I'll see you next week. Oh, Ben wants to say something.
Yeah. In terms of grading homeworks and getting them back to you, especially for people in Redmond who I can't hand papers to, just an email. Do you want me to make them available here? How do people prefer to receive their feedback?
Email, because we can't go there. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Email is the best approach for everybody.
Doesn't sound like anybody here has an objection.
Sounds good.
Great.
Maybe you can just like add comments in the code that we sent you or something like that.
I will probably send the comments in the emails.
Oh, that would be.
I also should point out that I'm going to be away for the next week. I will have sporadic email access, and you will not be getting your homeworks back anytime before Tuesday.
Yeah. Yeah, Ben will be out of town for about a week. I'll be out of town for 2 days, but you'll probably not notice. And we'll go from there. But homework two isn't due for 2 weeks. And yeah, and Ben's replied to enough emails for a lifetime, I think. Yeah. Okay.
Well, maybe we should have done a class discussion list rather than send Ben all the emails then.
Yeah, you know, it's a balance. You know, on the one hand, I mean, I have no problem, and it's kind of up to us, you know, with... some homework questions, particularly camel sort of stuff, to the list. If people are comfortable with that, that's fine. On the flip side, you know, so the list kind of serves multiple purposes, and I don't want to create like seven different lists. Like, you know, I definitely want you guys to, you know, read the list pretty regularly. It doesn't have to be like every 2 seconds or, you know, but every day or two, especially if I sort of announce like, oh, I fixed something on the homework. So low traffic list is good to make sure people read stuff. But it doesn't have to be so low that only Ben and I write to it. So, you know, I mean, this comes up in every class, right? I don't think I've that much super new to say, as long as we get a good balance.